Session number 22084, Reel 8.
Talking about your particular illness at the time, but I wanted to ask what the average soldier thought of the genuine threat of the Germans at this stage coming through Turkey to where you were.
We felt it was a real thing, particularly as Rommel was coming straight down the Libyan coast into Egypt, and it was felt, and quite correctly, that once he took Cairo, he had virtually controlled the Middle East, because then we were advised of his troops would probably come down through the Caucasus and close on the canal also, so he'd have the lot stitched up. We were concerned about that. We weren't losing any sleep over the night, but that's the scenario as we saw it. We also thought of the possibility of being attacked by sea, but it didn't take any part in our training. For most part, our training in Syria was developing our defensive positions in that area. And I suppose that's, and going for long route marches, keeping fit, and things like that. And that's about it. About it. In fact, in retrospect, thinking about the training or lack of training that we had, I'm amazed that we really got so little training all the way through, probably because our senior officers didn't know either. They hadn't been trained to it either, and everything was new to them. I think if there were another war, that if I were to have my little part in it, I'd ensure that everybody was far better trained. Far better trained.
To what degree then was this a period of relaxation in a way?
Yes, it was, and thoroughly enjoyable, because as you would expect, going to a place like the Lebanon, the beautiful Lebanon with the cedars and so on, from the desert, and even in Jerusalem or in Palestine, Cairo 89, the area was sort of pretty flat and uninteresting. Yes, it was really a good time, and we enjoyed all those things that I mentioned earlier. The scenery, the snow, the difference, the mixing more with the Arab population, the Lebanese. And there was an interesting episode there, too, that I can recall for if you were looking for any sort of human input. One was swimming in a little stream where the water was coming straight off the mountains there. It was so fresh and clear. So, and I was sitting with under this little waterfall. It was only a very small waterfall, and it was coming right up from the rocks above, right over my head, and I was encased by this virtually a shade of water. And I was there completely on my own and feeling wonderful, being so isolated, singing my echo, my shadow, and me. The other thing was when I had to do an inspection of some Arab huts, because a couple of rifles had been stolen, not from our particular camp, but I had to go in and search. And the couple looked very homely, very modest to extreme, virtually a simple rock hut with no luxuries in our sense. But they're friendly people. I just had this feeling of suspicion that they're being friendly because they felt it worthwhile being friendly rather than antagonistic. But I must say that I had, whilst I had these doubts about them, this reserve towards them, I was still quite friendly with them. And I went and told them I had to search their premises. And so they asked me if I'd like to have a glass of milk. So I said, yes, I would accept their hospitality. So they called in their animal, cow, I think it was, and they milked it on the spot. and then they strained it into a jug, glass jug, that had so many fingerprints all over it. I don't think it's seen hot water in its life by the look of it. And a muslin cloth which they put over the top, which also was totally grotty, and they poured the milk through this into the jug, and from that into my glass, which they handed to me, and the glass was also so fingerprinted. And so I thought, well, for king and country, for goodness knows what I'm going to get out of this. But nothing happened. But that was just a happy little memorable experience of Syria, on that part of it. So Syria itself, the township, or the Syria, was quite an interesting city, not a big one, but we saw Robert. And
I'm interested in talking about the fact that there are these moments that you have, even though you're really there for king and country, as it were.
Yes, they're different experiences. And these little facets of life which polish up and give you a greater feeling of the whole. And had it not been for the war, there is no possible way I could have had those specific, unique experiences. So, yes.
We had mentioned a little bit about some of the events that were going on in the wider war experience. What were your feelings of the Japanese and the threat that might be eventuating at home?
They were there. We expected to be recalled at any time. I think it was around about that time that the 16th Battalion, 2nd 16th, were recalled, and others of the 7th Div, 7th Australian Division. Our division was called upon to remain. Whether all of it or part, I'm not quite sure now, but we were very concerned about the loss of Tobruk. We were conscious, I think I might have mentioned earlier, of Rommel coming down and the danger of that. So I don't suppose we looked too far ahead. It was just it seems to me that at my age and in those days, you took life almost on a day-by-day basis as to where you were and what you did and what the immediate future could do. For example, what the enemy might do, what you might do, or where you might have to go, whether you're going to go back up into the desert, another position in the Lebanon, or back to Australia, whatever. And it was a time of obvious change. Things you knew things were going to happen, but you didn't know what was going to happen. And our time in up there in Forglos, our training was cut short. Certainly mine was cut short because of worms. So I was lifted out of that before it was completed, as I was out of Druk because of the headwind. And from there, if you want me to carry on, I went to the Beirut hospital, and I was starved for the appropriate number of days, and then on whatever day it was, the sixth day, or when I was supposed to have the knockout pill that they were going to bring me, and the nurse came with some eggs and toast, and I said, "But I can't have these. I'm supposed to get the pill today." She said, "Well, I'm sorry, they've run out of pills because of this epidemic of tapeworm. We've run out of pills, and so we've got to wait for the next lot to come." I said, "Well, have I got to stay here until they come?" She said, "Yes." I said, "How long is that likely to be?" She said, "Oh, at least 6 weeks, probably a lot longer, but at least 6 weeks." By this time, I'd been aware that the battalion had been called up to the desert. Goodness me. So,
what were your feelings on that situation?
Well, by this time, my warrant had been well confirmed, and in fact, when I was in the Tobruk hospital, the colonel, battalion colonel, came up to me to say that, "Hurry back, Potter, you're down for the next doc too." So that was the most important thing in my mind. So I thought, what I've got to do is get back to that battalion as fast as I can so that I can get off to that op too. I suppose if I had one ambition in the war, and that was to get my commission. I think that's why I went out on a number of patrols, which I may not have had to do otherwise, but still that's... So I decided that I just have to leave the hospital, which I did. So I managed to arrange for get my uniform. And so I bailed out of the hospital, went AWL again. But this wasn't held against me. I've heard nothing more of it. And so then another interesting episode was finding my way back from Beirut down through Syria, through Palestine and the desert, across the canal into Egypt, my own transport, and then finally finding the Australian Army and then my battalion and so on. That was a very interesting episode.
Tell us then about that occasion.
Well, all the way, I do remember reading, goodness me, an American book. Well, the name just eludes me. We'll come back. Anyway, that's incidental. Going through was interesting. That I had no papers, obviously, and so I'd front up to the transport officer in whatever railway station, and mention my predicament, show him my paybook, and tell him what I was about, where I wanted to go. And I had no trouble. I just sort of fed on. They fed me on from one to the other. And then when I ran out of trains, which was around about at Cairo, or might have been Alexandria, then I had to plumb transport. And so I found where the respective transport area and down something, transport going up. And then was moved from battalion to battalion, whatever staging camp they were at. And it was in one of these where I had the job of the Australian troops were into attack on this by this time. This was around about the 13th, 16th of July, 42, and things were consolidating.
On your way up, what was your, I assume sort of around the middle of June on, what were your experiences of what people were feeling regarding the onset and the coming of the Germans?
I didn't discuss it with any of them because there's nobody in the hospital that I really want to discuss it with. From then on, I was in trains or whatever. I was very much sort of on my own and reading the book Gone with the Wind suddenly come back to me. And that's a good book to keep you enthralled for that sort of, you need a fairly long journey for it. I can't remember any conversations with anyone. I must have had them. There must have been other people in carriages and things. But there's no memorable conversation that I would want to recount now. I can't recall any of them.
The general feeling, though, in the air about the Germans coming closer to Alexandria, the fact that you're heading up to a war situation, reading the book Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, but as a soldier, you're in a, well, for this soldier anyway, you're in a pretty isolated sort of a situation. You've got a one-track mind. You know what you're at, what you're about, within the confines of your own occupation, and you're not mixing too much with the local population in any event, nor are you, or nor was I, in any event, some may have been, certainly not I, very concerned about trying to analyse the effects or really observe. Because to do that, you've got to be mixing with the local population. You've got to be in messes and have the opportunity to mix with groups of people. But you don't do that.
Was there a degree of panic that you
saw? Not that I'm conscious of. I am not conscious of any panic. I can't even recall there being panic on my behalf, concern. I wanted to get up there before too much happened. But that's the only thing. There's no sort of real, I can't remember any great fear. Although, once I rejoined the battalion and was immediately given back my position of company sergeant major of B company, and then pretty well we went straight into attacks. And on the we had a company attack on a tank that had been knocked out or was there, and was on that occasion that this, where I live, is Bird Street. And the fellow, the lieutenant who was killed on this occasion was Frank Bird, one of the family, just coincidentally. And on that occasion, a typical thing again, that they opened fire, we all went to ground, And then as we got up, he was plugged right through the forehead again. Typical. You know, that seems to be a not unusual sort of a thing. So Tweet Bird died. The next day, we had another attack at least on the 22nd of July. We did our first attack on Ruin Ridge, and that was to be done with tanks, where we were to be aboard the tanks. We had to be taken in, that we would go forward when within 100 yards or two of the enemy. The infantry would be dropped off. The tanks would go in to consolidate, to wipe out. We would move in to consolidate. Well, that was well and good. A couple of things went wrong there. In that, firstly, my company commander was held up at the conference, which was far too late. By the time he got back, we were all ready to move, so there's a lot of mucking around. Instead of company headquarters, which is just as well, being put on tanks, we had to walk because they didn't have enough tanks coming through. It was the 50th Tank Battalion, a British tank who'd never been in action. They're coming to the desert for training. They had no training, and I believe they're on their way to Burma. They were brought in. Once they got under fire, they really didn't know where they were at, and the Germans by this time had their new 88mm, which were superb guns, artillery, and with great night sight as well, night sighting. And with the tanks that went forward, we actually captured out the objective, or got to the objective. But the Buller Beams, who had taken over from Tweet Bird, 10 platoon, he had gone to an octu, came back, he was back a day, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. He had gone to Tobruk, probably one of the last ones. He took the vacancy there and went off and spent the rest of his time doing courses. For that one day, he came in, and he was put on the tank with his sergeant, Bruce Hill. Oh, delight, lovely fellow, and a good friend of mine, didn't live too far from me. And they were hit. Believed that picked up the officer's pips, and of course Bruce Hill would have had his sergeant stripes, and they knocked it. Now, of those two, Buller Beams were blown up and came down. His body was pretty well intact, but it was as if, to pick him up was like jelly, as if everything inside him had been broken. Most incredible thing. Bruce Hill had both legs blown off, and of course he died pretty shortly after that. So that was, but our battalion commander, who had been 2RC of another battalion, he'd been with us as 2RC, then went to another battalion and done training. He'd really had no real battle experience. He was given command of the battalion. And it was a bit of a problem because I think the immensity of it was a bit much for him. And without wanting to elaborate, it was a stuff-up. We were recalled, we had to retire about 2,000 yards. By the time we got back into that, we had no field of fire. We were very badly sighted and positioned, just as well they didn't attack. On the way through, we'd been going by advancing, instead of on the tanks, the rest of the company were advancing on foot, and my orderly room corporal was hit, top of his head was blown off. Here's a nice bloke too. He used to have a photograph by his, we'd share the same tent in Syria. He had this photograph of his wife, and every night without fail, he'd say, "Well, good night, darling, keep your legs together till I see you." So he never saw her. And we were expected to go into attack on Ruin Ridge the next day. Now, the trucks came in and they threw off greatcoats for us and just grabbed anybody to have something to put over you because it's a bit cold over the night in the desert. And of course, I got the corporal best one because he's a big bloke and I knew there'd be a bit of coverage in it. And there I was that night, and it was probably might have been about the worst night I'd had because I had two out of the Buller's gone, 10 platoon, Tweet's gone, 10 platoon. I'm to be given 10 platoon as platoon commander. three in a row, you know, and that was sort of, I suppose, with the tension of everything else too. Anyway, it didn't happen, and it wasn't until the night of the 26th midnight that we actually did the full attack on Ruin Ridge.
Mm. Going back a way, on your arrival at El Alamein, what did you understand of the situation at the time, and what were you told about what was going on?
Well, we knew of the Quetaro Depression, which was sort of very, very soft sand coming in, which limited the area that vehicles and so on could come through. So it was something of a bottleneck. Now, for Rommel to go through, he'd have to go on one side of the Quetaro Depression and or come through where we were. Well, we were in that, broadly speaking, neck between that and the coast. And this area, it's been pretty well contested for 2 or 3 days, at least. It was quite a critical spot. Now, as a point of interest, that is the... Rommel didn't get beyond that line. That's as far as he got. And if he had broken through there, it's considered that he would have got straight through to Cairo. There would be nothing to stop him. And there's another interesting thing about that particular thing... area, but it was quite a dominant feature there as well at Tel Eliza station. What else can I mention to you about that?
I wanted to know what you understood as your objectives for that particular location.
It wasn't explained to us in full, but it was in simple terms. We had to, at this point, capture Ruin Ridge, and we just had to contain Rommel. We just had to hold the line. It was simple as that. There was no big story. We just had to hold the line. That was it. We had to capture that objective and hold the line there, hold that defensive position in that area.
What was your sense of confidence knowing, you know, that Rommel was now pushing in?
Well, strangely enough, I honestly here, I don't think my mind is playing tricks with me. I don't think there was an area of concern. I think as soldiers, we just sort of, there was a job that we had to do. And I can't remember, there's no sense of defeat that we're going to be defeated by it. I think it's sort of part of the Australian psyche, but the majority don't think that way. You know, there's an objective and that's it. You know, if you're playing a game of football or whatever, you're going in to win. You're not expecting yourself to be beaten. I can't consciously think that I was going to be beaten, but that night, I must say that going back into the desert that time, I did have a bit of an inner feeling of dread that I'd had so much good luck that I thought that I could run out of luck. I couldn't see how that luck could continue the way it had, and so I had that feeling of sort of a round the gut, a sort of feeling of dread going back into it again. Would you say it's fear? Yeah, perhaps it was fear. But I remember that night particularly being the third in a row, and I sort of could see the writing on the wall there, which didn't happen, of course. So, do you want to hear about the attack on Ruin Ridge? It was very well planned well planned in degree. The battalion had to go forward, a couple of thousand yards, whatever it was, and we had this is a silly part, we had a road on one side, which was the boundary. A road is not a boundary. It was a boundary for our advance to be, that was to the road. But a road is no boundary. And our engineers had gone through the night before, and they had, well, before anyway, and they had cleared a space through the minefield, and they'd put a white tape running down through it. And it was the area wide enough for the battalion to get through, with two companies forward and two behind. We crossed the line at midnight. My company commander was held up again at conference. We had a new battalion. The other one had been given a bowler hat out of that position, probably moved up the line. And he was a very good soldier, McCarthy. And... when we went forward, it was copybook. We crossed it at midnight. The artillery immediately started. Their artillery honed in on us pretty quickly, and we just had to keep moving. I think that's what I can remember very clearly, you know, constantly calling out, keep moving, because when the shells come over, people have a tendency to go to ground, and then for some of them, it's very difficult for them to get off the ground. You know, it's, and in fact, one or two of them didn't get off the ground. They stayed, and nothing happened to them. And then the position was taken sort of brilliantly with bayonets and so on, you know, the full bit, and we consolidated on that position. Now, there are a couple of things, interesting things there from my personal point of view. As company sergeant major, I had certain things, responsible things. Now, also, that made me, at that time, 2RC of the company. With Johnny Lowe, who had been the 2RC, he was a lieutenant, he was the company commander. I had to, firstly, send out patrols. Orders would come through to send out a patrol to knock out that machine gun, something like that. So I didn't have to take out a patrol to do it, but I had to get a runner to go to a particular platoon for that platoon commander to get the patrol to do it. The CSM is also responsible for ammunition. You've got to get your ammunition score, you've got to get your casualty reports, you know, these sort of things. You've also got to dig in very rocky ground. It's just, well, I wasn't 6 foot. It would have been a... And that, all those sort of things take a bit of time. And there's a war going on around you. It's not as if you're, you know, everything's nice and peaceful on a summer night.
As I understand... were taken too.
Oh yes, prisoners were actually fed back through a centre line, and if you know, sort of if you've got a few prisoners, you could dispatch somebody to take them. But as you're getting closer to your objective, there was a point there, and I've thought about this. I was saying earlier, this has got me thinking, giving you this information here, that poor fellow, that German with his hands up, I suppose he was going sideways, because if you have a line of troops advancing, it's the line of least resistance. You'd have to go out the side. You wouldn't want to go through them, particularly when they've got fixed bayonets, and you've got to sort of try and walk through the centre of them. It's logical to go with the flow, like swimming across the tide. And if you're trying to get through a rip or something, you go sideways, don't you, through it. Be the same with that. But they would be fed back to the line, you know, to the tape, and taken down through the tape. But there comes a time when you can't. You've got a choice with one prisoner. Do you lose a man to get a prisoner back, or do you keep the man because you're going to need him? Yeah, it's interesting. There's certainly a few things like that. No doubt they've got answers for them, and I suppose you've got to use your brains a bit. But at the time and under the heat of the moment, you know, you do a lot of things spontaneously. But they're the sort of things that you should handle in training. You should know, okay, in this situation. So anyway, we got the objective, and then our support had to come through. Now, this is where there was trouble, because the Germans with their night sights on their 88mm could see what was virtually happening, and they saw our line of vehicles, the anti-tank guns, the six-pounders, that's the best we had, and our trucks with all our ammunition and that sort of thing, coming down this line. And so they put shells into it, and once before long they had this conflagration of vehicles. It was sort of like Guy Fawkes Night in big time. So I thought our fellows showed an incredible amount of bravery, because two trucks would get up to this area where all the fire was, and one would accelerate to get through, and as soon as he was hit, the other one would accelerate and go straight past him. So we did get a little bit of stuff up, not much. We did get something. We got a six-pounder up, one or two, I think.